Welcome to Packet Pushes, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology, and work life in the networking industry. During the week, we gather articles and ideas and then get a bunch of people together to flap our chins about them, get comfortable while we get around the workbench, and diagnose the problems of the network world with humor, wit, and conceivably even some technical talent. But today, we're having a show which is specifically focused on just one technology, shortest path bridging. As many of you know, data center networking has been undergoing a dramatic change, and the shift from the old spanning tree way of networks to layer 2 multipath has become a show between all the vendors as they race to announce technologies and products to support virtualization and higher densities in the data center as the world goes by. And you would have heard a lot of noise about Trill and QFabric and other proprietary solutions of various people, but perhaps the one that the packet pushers haven't talked a lot about is shortest path bridging. Shortest path bridging is a layer 2 multipath protocol that is developed by the IEEE, and it's something that we should be looking into because it's being supported by a large number of vendors. So, to welcome the people who are joining us on the show today, I'd like to welcome Ivan Pepelniak back to the show. How are you, Ivan? What have you been doing?
Pretty good, thank you. Awfully busy. So it looks like I got too deep into this webinar stuff. This week, I've been developing all the DMVPN things and testing all the non-working features in iOS release 15.1 something. Mm-hmm. Then I have to jump into virtualization for the new webinar. So it's
I did
busy.
Attend your Data Center Interconnect webinar this week and found it at least as good as your previous Enterprise MPLS one, if not better. I thought it was very well put together. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And also this week is our special guests who are very solid on spanning shortest path bridging. First of all, in no particular order, Paul Unbehagen from Alcatel-Lucent. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a technical director in the IP division at Alcatel-Lucent. I'm in charge of going after cloud standards and helping to align all the different networking issues going on around the planet with different customers and looking at how we continue to scale and solve different network problems.
Cool. Thanks for joining us. And also with us is Roger Lepou from Avaya, is that right?
Hi, everyone. This is Roger Lepou. I'm PLM for the modular Ethernet switching in Avaya, formerly Nortel, and focusing besides platform also on shortest path bridging. And I know that we're the first ones in the market with a real product generally available on shortest path bridging.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to be part of this team here.
Thanks very much for joining us as well. And finally, Peter Ashwood-Smith, how are you doing? Tell us a bit about yourself.
So hello, my name is Peter Ashwood-Smith. I work for Huawei Technologies in Canada. I'm a research fellow and have a small research organization studying evolution of data center issues, metro Ethernet, and a variety of networking problems and possible potential solutions. Been looking at Ethernet in particular for the last, five, 6 years now.
Fantastic. And thanks for joining us on the show. So the first thing to do for the audience is probably to introduce you to shortest path bridging. So probably the best thing to do is to have a bit of a introduction to SPB, shortest path bridging. And let's get Paul to tell us a bit more about what SPB is and how it came about and how it works.
SPB is short for shortest path bridging. It's the actual IEEE standards, 802.1AQ. For basically the next generation of control plane for Ethernet, with the design intent to handle both major forms of encapsulation of Ethernet, which is just standard Ethernet, like every one of our PCs or routers ships out today. But it also handles another form called PBB, which is called provider backbone bridging, which is nothing more than putting a MAC header on top of the existing header coming out of your machine. And that's a form of it is called SPBM. To do regular Ethernet, it's called SPBV, and the V stands for VLAN, just regular Ethernet. The M stands for the MAC and MAC function. And as we were looking at this, we don't generally, in the IEEE that is, we don't generally look at how do we solve a problem for data center or how do we solve a problem for metro Ethernet. It's how do we solve a problem for all Ethernet. And to even get past creating a PAR, you have to pass certain gates. Like, for example, is this solving a real world problem? Is this something that will help drive the price down to a commodity level so it can be put on the simplest little switch like you might buy from your local electronics store, all the way up to the multi-$1,000 modular switch you'd buy and put in the core of a network and have to scale equally. So what its design intent is and what its actual use and application oftentimes get confused. Those IEEE documents can be very difficult to read. And one of the most confusing things we start seeing coming out of this is people think we're just redesigning BPDUs, which is a complete falsity. There is no BPDUs involved inside of an SBB domain. It is pure ISIs. In fact, we haven't changed anything to ISIs. We added less information to ISIs than the IETF did when it added IP. And being an active contributor to both the IETF and the IEEE, I can tell you it is a very small amount of information we added. This was actually design intent so that you can reuse the 30 years of burnt-in experience and code that ISIS has out there. So we got a lot of experience out there. Myself, having to work in MCI, I've dealt with thousands of nodes participating in one ISIS area. It scales beautifully. Also, another value of it is that it runs directly on layer 2. There's no IP encapsulation, right, between two nodes who have an adjacency, which made it a perfect stand-in. Another thing about it is so to do, for example, the PBB control function, since PBB has this internal MAC address that you use inside the network, and then that transports all the client MACs coming from the virtual machines or the PCs or the routers or whatever might be connected to it, that addresses are kept on the provider side, the internal, the network itself. We can actually populate that using the actual system ID from each node. Now, if you're not familiar with ISIS, what a system ID is, it's the granddaddy to a router ID. All right, so if you're familiar with configuring any router out there with ISIS, you know you have to configure a router ID in OSPF, but in ISIS you configure this hexadecimal address. Well, that hexadecimal address is actually 6 bytes. It has to be unique in the topology, which makes it a perfect stand-in as a nodal MAC address. So anytime you want to send a packet from node A to node Z across the network, it will simply put itself as the source address and Z as the destination address, and every switch in the middle will have a pre-configured FIB, very, very similar to MPLS, and there's a reason for that. And every switch in the middle is simply doing cut-through switching to get directly to that node.
So a packet comes, so in SPB, so SPB is a replacement for spanning tree, the protocol that we've known and loved. So we're taking spanning tree, and it's no longer a part. And SPB replaces it in the sense that it provides layer 2 multipathing through the core.
Well, I'll actually go a step further. It actually replaces SDP, RSDP, MSDP, MMRP, MVRP all in one shot.
All of those things. in... Thank goodness. It's time, isn't it not? Is it not time for...
God bless you.
Yes. I mean, the introduction of a link state protocol adds so many possibilities. And not just can you compute shortest paths or compute various forms of trees, you have the opportunity to advertise membership information, and this is something that really makes this protocol so very simple compared to, if you compare, for example, the MPLS protocols that do the equivalent of a layer 2 VPN, the VPLS protocols, they have a considerable amount of complexity because they have to have protocols to advertise the topology and protocols to signal the connectivity, and then they have protocols to advertise membership. And what we've done with shortest path bridging is we've essentially put all of these things into one protocol, ISIS. And in fact, if you look at the work that's been done, it has, I think, in fact, the ISIS TLVs were a little bit, were just announced the actual numbers by IANA. But there's only 5 of them. It's a fairly simple set of additions to ISIS that we've done to advertise membership information, topology information, and everything else is a computation. So, I mean, you can think of shortest path bridging as a combination of existing things like the MAC and MAC data path, the ISIS protocol, and the Ethernet OANM. So those 3 things exist. They're very well known and well deployed, and we don't have to play with them. But then on top of that, we add computations and information about which ports are to be bridged to which other ports across this network. And if you combine all of those together, that's essentially shortest path bridging. That's the easiest way I know how to describe it.
There's a nice little nuance, actually, in something Peter just said there. If you actually kind of dig a little underneath and find a summary in there, is everything that's being done to SPB is a very finite amount of things being done that needs to be done to add a tremendous amount of capability. And that is every single major vendor out there supports PBB and regular Ethernet and Q and Q&Q. All of that is deployed infrastructure for nearly a decade and many decades for regular Ethernet. ISIs, many decades of deployment, right? We didn't change anything. There's no new PDUs. There's no new hellos. None of that. It's simply just additional TLVs in those existing areas. So what you have now is just a simple TLV additions to protocols that have been deployed for decades that now give us a monumental capability, mind-bogglingly simpler to manage and deploy.
So let me just paint a verbal picture. So we're standing around the virtual whiteboard and we're waving our hands at this point. So what we've got is a backbone of switching infrastructure. We have, I don't know, 10 switches which are all fully meshed together. And each of those 10 switches is running an SPB protocol. The protocol suite's actually made up of ISIS routing protocol between the 10 switches in the full mesh, and they're signaling over CLNS Ethernet frames to set up neighbor relationships and establish adjacencies. Am I correct so far?
Just a bit, Greg. ISIS does not run over CLNS. It's a separate layer 3 protocol.
What am I missing?
Yeah.
It's just a regular Ethernet. It's AO2. It's just a regular Ethernet header.
It runs directly on layer 2. It does not run over CLNS.
Right.
So you don't need to configure CLNS addresses, for example. Sorry to jump into details at this point. Paul?
Good clarification.
You are running all in one area, right?
Right now, yeah, definition is in one area. Doesn't mean we can't do
multiple. So you're running level 1 ISIS routers, effectively?
Effectively, correct. Yes.
Okay, so you don't need CLNS addresses. You just need system IDs, which are 6-byte MAC addresses.
That's correct.
Exactly.
For those people out there who have configured ISIS before, don't be scared. You don't have to learn new CLNS addresses to run SPB.
In fact, actually, it goes even easier, Ivan. You know why? Because every single vendor out there who does ISIS today has the ability to automatically grab a chassis MAC and make that the default system ID, so you don't even have to configure it. In fact, that's the option we prefer in the standard.
Yeah, as long as you are level 1 only. When you go to level 2, you need area ID, so you need CLNS addresses.
And the nice thing about that is a CLNS address is just a combination of that system ID and your area ID, right? So to simply go to multi-area, all we have to do is say you need to configure an area ID. The chassis MACs still can be derived out of it just as easy.
And we already have – that's already an existing process because we already use the chassis MAC, say, for legacy spanning tree where it's the bridge ID.
All right. And there's – really important thing here, by the way, all the concepts you know about regular Ethernet, about flood and learn, reverse learning, and God help you, source bridging, that is where you have a root bridge, and have all the multicast files, is gone. Yes. All of
so
it's
what
gone.
I was trying to, I'll come back to the virtual whiteboard. So now we have a ring of switches. They're fully meshed. Well, they could be partially meshed. There's actually no, physically we've got the switches patched together in some way. ISIS is actually enabled. Now, for the listeners who haven't heard of ISIS before, it's a routing protocol, a bit like OSPF in a way. Historically, or in the current environment, we normally use it for IP routing. However, ISIS was used for many things in years gone by, and IRP is the one that's just what's left after all the other technologies have faded away. It's quite a wonderful protocol. It's used extensively in some of the largest carrier backbones in the world. And as Paul was saying, is that it's been around for so long, we actually have working code trains and lots of experience among the people who write the code to actually build better reliable software. That would be the sort of logic behind that.
Yeah,
that's right.
Switches are running ISIS. Each switch actually has built itself up as a neighbor routing using a stateful routing protocol, not unlike OSPF in that it's uses a shortest path first algorithm to establish its routing table and to forward to various destinations.
There's a little more detail to the shortest path than just shortest path, because we actually guarantee that the routes are symmetric. So that's an additional detail.
Right. So what would happen is all the switches around the edge here would then say, I've got this MAC address over here, and it would announce the MAC address of each endpoint connected to the switch to all other switches.
No. Think of it this way. Yep. Let me take a step back. All right. Think about the way any link state routing protocol works. All right. OSPF, ISIS, hell, you can even throw PNNI. They're all based off DECnet, DECnet 4, right?
5.
Yeah, 5. Thank you.
I was just going to say.
All right. But the point is that as a link state protocol, what it does, it sends out announcements about itself. In OSPF, we call them LSAs, and we have a handful of them. All right. 5 we only really care about at any given time. unless you're in TE. And in ISIS, we have a single link state advertisement called a link state PDU. All right. The biggest thing about what we do there is that we can simply add or remove TLVs out of this basic catalog of what is about this node. And that catalog, that link state PDU, simply says at the very top, my name is, and this gives a system ID, which to us is also the nodal MAC, right? And then it also goes down through a series of things. For example, it'll list the number of IPv4 addresses it has configured on it, a list of its neighbors so we can run Dijkstra calculations so we know who's connected to who. Goes through also if there are TLVs for IPv6, and then there's also a couple of TLVs for hellos, and there's TLVs for this ICID functionality that we have is so that we can do SPB. And there's even a nodal thing that we use for SPB so we can do algorithm checks and things like that. What that does is that then on every given node, you have a complete list of every one of these link state PDUs from every single node participating in that level. So when you're going through and you're calculating the graph, you see a graph of connectivity based on these system IDs, these nodal MACs to us in SPB, right? And then anything hanging off of it, whether it's IP or whether it's an ICID or a VLAN to SPB, simply has a leaf node hanging off of it.
They're computing the topology of VLANs and ports, not MAC addresses. Okay. And then they do dynamic learning of MAC addresses like we did before in traditional bridging.
I don't quite like explaining it that way because it actually kind of just think about it this way. The system IDs themselves are your MACs. We're not sharing any MAC addresses from clients though.
No. You do dynamic MAC address learning of client MAC addresses. Sorry.
Correct. Yes, over the top.
Yeah, over the top. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not shared in any protocol. That's a very dangerous, dangerous thing to do.
Absolutely.
And the learning is only at the edge. That's very important. It's not in the core. Only the edge and UNI interfaces are learning the end user MAC addresses.
It's that are participating in that service. You never send frames to paths that don't need it.
Okay, now we have to be careful. What you just said is true for SPBM. In SPBM, a core switch never sees a client MAC address.
That is correct.
For SPBV, we probably still need to learn all the MAC addresses everywhere, don't we?
No, not necessarily. No. Because you really just need to learn your topology, and you start learning where your MAC addresses are. The core switches themselves don't need to learn the MACs because they're not doing hop-a-hop. You just simply put the frame on the right vid, and it'll switch all the way there. Each vid is a topology from each node.
Okay, so in the core, you switch on vids.
Yes.
Not on MAC addresses and vids.
Exactly.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah, very cool. In fact, when you combine the two together, you get some pretty powerful topologies. And by the way, to take a step back, there's something here I always confuse. Remember how I said we didn't change the hellos? We didn't change any of the existing TLVs? If you have an ISIS topology today running IP, you can turn SPB mode on. It'll simply announce its capability to also do SPB, and the same boxes running ISIS IP today, suddenly on those links that you configure it on, can now also do SPB forwarding.
I found this really awesome because that way you also solve the management problem for the core switches.
Exactly. Yes, and in fact, very early on when we were designing the precursor to SPB was actually referred to as provider link state bridging, PLSB, which is sort of historically where some of this work came from. One of the big things we wanted to do was not affect the existing ISIS deployments. We wanted to be able to just insert SPB as another network layer protocol, and therefore if you were running ISIS for IPv4 or V6, if you had some other new protocol in the future that goes in ISIS, that they could all just get along in the same link state protocol. And so the obvious IPv4 to carry in parallel with SPB is the operations and management IP addresses and so forth. So it's a very, very neat and powerful thing to just be able to plug this network together and not only be able to produce your layer 2 connectivity, but also layer 3 connectivity to allow you to operate and manage it without any real configuration.
Yeah, that's perfect. Okay, now if I can go into one question that's always been bothering me about SPBM and SPBV. Why did you choose to implement both?
Because go back to when I did the intro, you have two encapsulations of Ethernet, right? No, but let me step back for a second. So you had the V mode. And V mode's nice to a certain scale, right? Because you can do Q and Q as well as Q. But when you start looking at some of these topologies out there that exist, where, for example, that very large ones for Metro Ethernet, even when we talk to cloud providers who are more interested in going to PBB, they don't even want to think about using regular Ethernet in their core because of scaling, security, isolation all the way down to the top of rack for the virtual machines all the way out to branch offices. You have to have better control of that layer underneath. So if you think about what happens in PBB, that layer in which we add that extra Ethernet encapsulation is regular Ethernet. Today, in all environments, it's deployed, and it's deployed in every single major service provider around the world. They use regular Ethernet control plane protocols underneath it. So the value of using SPBM is that we can simply go in and just upgrade the switch with the new with this ISI capability, and you just turn on SPB. The other nice thing about it is that all the VLANs that are currently running today to support this regular Ethernet or the PBB environment, right, continue to run. We run SPB on a whole different set of VLANs, so they can run side by side through the entire infrastructure, and you can migrate what you want and migrate what you don't want, however way you need.
I think that there are other reasons, too. I mean, that the IEEE is a standards organization, and as such, there are a large number of people with different approaches and problems that they're trying to solve. So it's fairly normal that a standard will encompass more than any one particular person might wish to deploy. That's every standards body I've ever been in.
That's a good point. I mean, it wasn't even a thought or a debate of whether or not we should actually try and control regular Ethernet and PBB. It was just given. It was done.
Yeah.
But the two can't interoperate, can they?
Yes, they can. So in fact, they can run side by side.
Can you have like the access layer running on SPBV because lower end switches that don't have a chipset, and
that's
then in the core.
I see what you're asking. So the question you're asking is, can I have a layer of switches like racks, for example, running V mode, and a layer of aggregation switches aggregating running M? Building those aggregation switches. He's simply got to be aware of that. He's going to configure this ISID up there, and then he's going to, on the aggregation switches, and tie in the certain VIDs coming in from the access switches into the right ISID and proper router. We do this every day using regular Ethernet. Whatever the control plane underneath is really irrelevant.
Yeah, but if you do that, then you would have like a layer of SPBV sitting on top of a layer on SPBM, right?
No, you'd have a layer of SPBV connecting into another layer of SPBM. The two domains don't even have to know about each other.
So you wouldn't run one ISIS end-to-end?
Well, I'm saying you can do both. That's what I'm saying. The problem is with the virtual whiteboard is I can't draw little pictures for you.
So you've got to wave your hands, right?
Hands. And a lot of environments deployed today, right? In pretty much every major deployment I know of PBB today, right? We have ISIDs, and they are the next generation of a VLAN, by the way. You know, when you think about it from an IEEE perspective, they are the next generation to replace VLANs. But that doesn't mean VLANs go away. It just means VLANs now become the attachment circuits to the ISID.
So I want to explain an ISID quickly
to the audience
what an ISID is.
Why does PBB even exist? When the world was realizing we were going to start offering Metro Ethernet to replace ATM and frame relay and TDM, right? One of the biggest fears in the standards bodies was people were going to stop connecting routers to these environments, connecting LANs directly to these environments. And there was a massive fear on the service provider space that suddenly we're going to end up with billions of MAC addresses connected to different VPNs in some kind of combination and crush these networks. So PBB was invented for two reasons. One, Q&Q is having a large issue scaling because MAC addresses are proliferating up into the core switches, where it's easy to add services on an edge switch where you're only going to have 10 to 10,000 MACs, still not a problem. But when you have hundreds or thousands of those switches coming into a couple of core switches, and you have the aggregation of all those MACs coming there, they get crushed by that weight of all, and the RAM just runs out. PBB did another thing. It added this ability to call an ISID because Q&Q did something that was actually kind of wrong when you think about protocol design. It overloaded what a VLAN is. A VLAN was originally created purely to be the definition of a topology. That is, it simply defined a path to the network. It was never intended to be a VPN ID. And that's what Q&Q essentially started becoming, was that VLAN became both a VPN ID and a topology, and it was creating other issues. So PBB did several things. One, it grew the scale so that the number of devices hanging off the network could scale orthogonally to a total number of devices in the network, that is the switches, that is. So I can have 1,000 switches handling millions to billions of MAC addresses, and it all scales just fine. Separate, it added this ISID, independent service ID, and it is 24 bits in length. It defines a VPN. And I know VPN is kind of this overloaded term as well. It's the best way to think about it, but generally, if you think what a VLAN was becoming, it was becoming a VPN. So it defines simply an instance of this Ethernet LAN you want and where you want it to exist. What the intent is, instead of going and mapping out Q trunks throughout a network, you simply just define where you want the ISID to exist as attachment points, and a network automatically attaches them together.
It's a virtualization index. I think that's what I like. It's virtualization index. It allows you to virtualize whatever
like
you like on top
a root
of
descriptor. And from MPLS. It's a tag that says...
Sort of, yeah.
You can think of it that way, because actually in the ISIS protocol, when we distribute connectivity, the ISID is actually used to distinguish, to group the associated ports that we want bridged together. So in many ways, it does become that sort of an identifier. It's one identifier, and it does the job on the data path and on the control path.
Yeah, really nicely. It's very, very concatenated. It's so compact when you look at the TLV that lists all the ISIDs a node has. It only needs to be 32 bits long, 24 for the actual ISID, and a few reserve bits in there, and also one that allows you to build trees, unidirectional trees or full mesh of trees. It's using computation, as Peter was referring to earlier. But another thing is that we only need to announce where that ISID lives and how many ISIDs exist inside that environment, so that nodes know whether or not they need to connect these sites together and where they need to install the FIBs. Because by knowing where the ISIDs live, we ensure that we only install the FIB state to connect those sites together only where they need to. So you never end up with MAC addresses existing in FIBs that aren't even on the path between two nodes.
Oh, and the other thing that I also found interesting is that by using ISIDs, you actually limit the broadcast domains.
Exactly. Yes. That's exactly what I was pointing out. Yep.
The pre-computed limit to the broadcast domain. In fact, it might be worth just backing up slightly, because listening to the conversation, we are getting into some details that might be better to just back up a tiny bit. Maybe I could take you chronologically through what happens, and maybe your audience might find that useful, because Greg started out by saying, okay, you take your switches and you plug them together and it forms an ISIS topology, and that's correct. We learn the box MAC, we learn the MAC address that we're going to use to move traffic through this network from those individual switches. That's advertised along with the topology, and that's pretty much automatic. You don't have to do it. Up to this point, you have pretty much zero configuration to do. You now have a network of 20, 30, 100, 200, maybe even up to 1,000 switches that know the complete topology. And then it gets interesting. Now you go to the individual ports that are around this big network and say which physical or logical ports, either based on ACL mappings or the VID or STAG, you decide what of these ports you wish to be bridged to which others, and you give that set of ports an ISID or a number, so maybe 1,000 or 1,001, and you've got 2 to the 24 of these to pick. So you go to those ports and you say you are a member of a particular service or ISID. And that's, as a user, as the operator of the network, that's all you have to do. Everything else is automatic. Those are advertised into the link state topology, and then the computations will produce an optimum set of trees for the purposes of multicasting ARPs or other multicast or unknown unicast addresses between those different attachment points. And it will also produce optimal shortest path routes, up to 16 of them. We currently have 16 equal cost multipath between those different ports. So we'll be able to use all of the connectivity in this mesh network. You plug a link in, plug in a new NNI link, it will get used. So from an operations perspective, you really only have to do one step, which is configure the service attachment points. And in theory, a vendor could automatically learn and create mappings between what it sees coming into a port and what services it wishes to associate those with. Well, once all that's up and running, you now have the ability to run the Ethernet OANM, so you can do layer 2 ping, layer 2 trace route to tell you exactly what's going on in the network. And one of the most fascinating things that I find personally about shortest path bridging is that it is very, very deterministic in its behavior. So if you take an offline engineering tool, which some of us are building, you can predict exactly what the network's going to do. And when you take that offline engineering tool and then compare it to what the real network does, you will see, or you should see, exactly the same routes through the network. And what that means is that you can now actually do something that we've never been able to do before in a hop-by-hop forwarded network, which is a form of lightweight traffic engineering. I can actually decide that a particular flow of traffic should be taking a different path in order to better balance my network. So that's a knob that we've never really had before in a network, especially in an Ethernet network. Normally, you'd have to go to an MPLS network to get that. So that's sort of chronologically the complete sequence of things that you have to do.
There's another thing we add in there as well is when you think about these multicast trees that Peter's talking about, we added something called a default tree. So if you're familiar with MPLS, you're probably familiar with something called fast reroute. Right. One of the things we realized in the very beginning is that we had to have the ability to actually redefine a topology based on a failure as fast as possible. Because one of the questions that constantly came up was, well, what about fast reroute? Because as soon as people start realizing this sounds very similar to MPLS as far as switching and awareness of topology, they want to know how you heal it quickly. What we basically did is in the background is we added this, if you can think of, I hate using the term because it's a rather old term, but most people still understand it. It's called a bear channel. There's just this hidden ISID sitting in the background just used for management information. So if a failure happens between two nodes, the nodes will send out regular link state updates to each of its peers about the link failure between them. But they'll also do one other thing. They'll also take that link state advertisement and drop it on that tree, which means that every single node in the network that's part of that level is going to learn about that failure at nearly the speed of light, or really a better way to say is the summation of all link speeds from one end to the other. And they completely recalculate all trees that are affected by that link at the same time. And on many test cases we've proven, you can get some phenomenal convergence times. I'm talking sub 50 milliseconds.
So what you're doing is you're sending out flash updates.
A flash update of a failure, very particular link state updates.
Yeah, it's using, because shortest path bridging is essentially producing large multicast communities very quickly and easily, right? That's what we do. We produce these layer 2 VPNs for the use of the attached devices, but we can also create one for the purposes of the control plane. It's very easy to interconnect all the control planes over a broadcast media, which is a sort of a logical ISID that we've allocated for this purpose. It's essentially like having all of the ISIS instances directly connected to some hub somewhere. And so when one of them finds out about a failure, they're all going to find out about it at hardware speed.
Although I would say a switch, not a hub. Because we're not broadcasting it in the old Ethernet terms, right? We're multicasting it according to source path.
Okay. But thank you for the – I always get these terms confused. I'm a researcher. The point being that the link state protocols, one of the things that slows them down is the propagation of a control message from a link up into the control processor where it decides what the next outgoing hops for that control message should be. So there's a CPU and interrupts and various other events that get in the way of propagation of link state updates. And one of the things that we discovered very early on with shortest path bridging was that the use of a layer 2 VPN specifically for the purposes of the control plane allowed us to eliminate one of the larger bottlenecks in the recovery times of link state protocols. And we ran some tests, talking almost 4 years ago now, where we were seeing 20, 30 millisecond recovery times in a circular arrangement of devices, which for those of you that know about link state protocols, a circular arrangement of devices is actually the worst thing you can do for a link state protocol because the propagation of information goes through every single control processor or on average half the control processors. So it's it's quite a remarkable thing to see actually operating a link state protocol operating at those kinds of speeds.
But just to clarify it again for the listeners, all these beautiful things you're describing now only work with SPBM, right?
Yeah, that's the ISID definition, but you could do the same.
The ISID definition, yes.
So if you want to have all the beauties of SPB, you really should buy the high-end boxes that support SPBM, right?
Well, no, so the default tree function is a function of SPBM. Everything else works perfectly fine in all SPB variants. And you could even say you could create a tree variant using a vid between everybody else because you just drop that links to advertising around. Right? There's no reason why you couldn't pick it off that as well. This will be very clear, though. You're talking about high-end devices doing PBB. I can get you a very, very low-end device with chips that are off the shelf running PBB today for less than a couple hundred dollars. It's not like PBB is this great thing that you have to spend tens of thousands of dollars for. Right?
Yeah, I was going to highlight the same thing, is that the Mac and Mac encapsulation is supported on a wide variety of the different ASICs. And so it's not necessarily a choice that you have to make between V or M. You can pretty much step straight to M mode or should be able to on fairly low-end devices.
In fact, actually, a little look behind the curtain, if you've been buying top-of-rack switches or closet switches for the last 4 years, the PBB capability is actually in the chips of those various switches you've already been buying. Now, whether or not they turn it on in software is a different thing.
Yeah, it's all the rage.
Actually, it's more popular than you realize.
Okay.
Greg, this is Mac and Mac done right. This is not Mac yeah. and Mac done VMware's way.
Yes,
that's
we'll save
completely
that.
Different.
Yep. And we did have an eye at VMware. We had an eye at all that when we were designing this. So VMs could be moved easily across this, and nothing had to change anywhere, and no new encapsulations had to be invented.
So do you think that might imply that VMware would be interested in turning their hypervisors into nodes for SPBM?
They could, but they really don't need to. I mean, as far as they're concerned, they're just a node on the end, right? There's a whole lot of capabilities that were designed into it so that they didn't have to. If they want to, they can. No, there's no reason why they couldn't simply turn on the ISI's capability and peer up to the network with vSwitch. But
who would have to write the code? Come on.
You can get ISI's code for, you know, about 20,000 or 30,000. Yeah, it's free online.
It's free, yeah. But, I mean, the purpose of the encapsulation and creating a boundary is to create a boundary so that, you only have to do a specific thing at that boundary, and VMware would not have to do anything special. In fact, they haven't had to do anything special to run over. They're already running over PBB in many places and don't know about it.
Okay.
And they haven't had to do anything special to do that.
I agree with you, Peter, that VMware was running over PBB forever, and they didn't know it because for them it was just VLANs. But what would be really nice would be to have sort of an agreement between the vSwitch or the hypervisor host and the first PBB switch about what's needed. Because today you have to configure them independently, and there are usually two teams doing that.
To actually help with that, you're probably not aware of this, but the nice thing about the IEEE is that there's a whole bunch of work going on all at the same time, and people talk to each other about what they're doing. So there's work going on to simplify data center connectivity models in other areas of the IEEE. Actually, in the same inner working group, we're all sitting side by side, but instead of AQ, it's actually in a standard called QBG.
I know.
Right. So if you think about VDP, in fact, we went back and changed some of the other standards. All these standards are being worked on in unison, and we're passing things back and forth about what needs to be optimized on your side. So if you take QBG, which is, for those who don't know it, is redefining attachment models from the blade centers up into the network, they have a protocol built into it called VDP, VM Discovery Protocol. It'll have the ability to simply say, as soon as the VM pops up, to tell the network to attach that VM to the right ISID or VLAN or VEPA or VEB and all those combinations. So all these network components are becoming automated very, very quickly.
Oh, now the only thing you have to persuade VMware to implement at least some of these standards in their vSwitch.
Yes. The beautiful thing about capitalism is market demand will hopefully push them there.
Well, if they have 90% market share, you have a problem.
Well, I do know you have Dell, Microsoft, HP, all of them sitting in the room, and they are planning on implementing it. So they don't necessarily have to implement it themselves because the actual hardware underneath can do it.
Unfortunately, Paul, you're wrong. Because if it's implemented in HP's or Dell's hardware, and it doesn't work with vSwitch, then the only way to use it...
Okay, so you're saying, what I was referring to is VEB and VEPA could replace the vSwitch functionality for that, and policy servers are creating them can send messages.
Well, yes. If you just throw out the vSwitch and you attach the VMs to the physical NICs,
Well, VEP and VEB isn't physical. It's still it can be physical.
Right. I know. It's sort of logical physical.
Yes.
If you do that, then you can't do vMotion anymore.
You can do. That's actually something that's been proven. HP and I believe one other vendor. I don't want to say the name because I don't want to put them out there. But I know HP was public about them testing it at the last few IEEEs. You can absolutely do vMotion or some other open source version of vMotion. You know, using these capabilities because it doesn't really matter. We've had the ability actually in Ethernet to detect the movement of a VM before ever having these protocols because we do it using packet sniffing functions. Right?
Yeah, I know all that. You see, the problem is if you want work to interoperate with VMware, either you throw out their vSwitch like Cisco did with Nexus 1000V, or they have to implement the missing bits and pieces. So someone needs to do the work.
So the two things I'm hearing you saying is that, so we all agree you can run vMotion right now, and they have been over PBB, they just didn't know it.
Exactly.
Many times, right? Or we can go with a further optimization. You'd like to see vSwitch implement SPB?
No, EVB is just fine.
Yeah, I would disagree with you at all. I'd love to see him do it as well. I completely agree with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think the way the protocols are defined, though, it's perfectly possible to take a signal from an end server to trigger the addition or removal of an ICID. So the SPV protocol by itself is perfectly capable of taking a signal from any exterior device to cause the addition or removal of an ICID, which is kind of the one of the main functions required to move a VM, or at least to move a VM to somewhere that's not currently in that subnet.
Yeah, worst case, you could even trigger a vCenter to do this, right?
Yeah, that you could do
VMware
that.
VMware so far has been the people making the running on virtual networking and been able to lead the market in a direction that suits it. Whether VMware would see, you know, adopting those sorts of principles is questionable.
Well, so I tend to look at it differently. Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying, and that's a very good point when you think of it. When you're running, if you're in VMware and you're running their business, but now if you're a customer of VMware and you want the ability so that you can simply in vCenter just say add this VM or move this VM from site A to site B, but everything's completely automated via protocol, not via SNMP calls. Right, so that it's simply just to get down to brass tacks, the only thing that really we're talking about here is that all vCenter down the switch has to do is send out an LDP message up to the first switch, and it attaches it to the right ICID or the right VLAN. That's really incredibly lightweight. There's not much to add there.
Yeah, you could do the same thing that Arista is doing with the mTracer.
Yeah.
There's actually different vendor implementations which are monitoring, have an API into vCenter monitoring the locations of the VMs and based on that provisioning the network side as well. So this is that's absolutely needed in the market to have a solution for that. In my mind, the IEEE approach is definitely would be the way to go to make a common approach here. But right now we see many different versions of it out there.
But that's pretty typical, right, Roger? I mean, you think about any new protocols announced. I mean, think about MPLS when it first hit the market. I mean, before it is even called tag switching, it had several other names, right? We're going to end up, in the end, solidifying on an IEEE standard. I personally have no doubt about it.
Okay, so the conversation up to now has swung fairly wildly between what's needed in the carrier side or as a service provider to be able to provide a variety of Ethernet services or layer 2 services across service provider backbones, and as well as what we do in the data center. So the data center version of SPB is the same as the carrier one or the carrier.
Actually, that's the reason why when I went to the introduction, when we're defining these protocols in IEEE, we're not thinking about a carrier. We're not thinking about a data center. We're not thinking about a campus. We're thinking about Ethernet. This protocol would work in every one of these environments perfectly fine. No issues and scale beautifully.
I think it's very important to mention to that in SPB, because it is using this ICID, this virtualization index, it is perfectly suited for any data center or host data center environment where we need layer 2 virtualization beyond just the VLAN identifier. That's a key attribute for a data center deployment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it also works really nice if you're running a campus. Right, being able to say you want to have different people in different VLANs, the old world model of why we described VLANs, Now you say you simply just configure the ISID wherever you want it in the network, and the network automatically connects them together, and the world of having to go through that nightmare of managing queue trunks is gone.
Okay, so let me bring that back to an extension, because obviously there's a competitive space here where SBB and Trill in the data center have an overlap. Now, my understanding is that Trill, as a protocol, is getting a lot of airtime. It seems to have come to market perhaps earlier than SBB has. But my understanding is that Trill is specifically for the data center. You wouldn't use it in the campus, and it's unlikely to be viable in the service provider space because it doesn't scale big enough to allow that to happen.
Well, they'll probably make arguments that you can put in a campus and you can put in a data center, but you're not going to get a service provider to deploy this in any core anywhere.
It's not a carrier technology, period.
No, but let's take a step back. There's numerous reasons. Right. One is obviously exactly what you pointed out, their scale. It has this very, very low scale. It still has that problem of 4,000, vids. Also, they recreated for some strange reason the idea of a source bridge. So multicast and unicast don't take the same path unless you make every node a source bridge, but then you're sending frames to every other single node, whether or not they have the service on them or not. Additionally, there's no ANM. Excuse me, OANM. Right. We went through great lengths to add Ethernet OANM, where you can do ping and trace routes at layer 2, you can do connectivity checks, but even better, especially in a data center world, we can do latency and jitter checks between attachment points of an ISID or a VLAN. It doesn't matter. We can do it in every version of SPB, because now if you want to move a VM from top of rack 1 to top of rack, say, 45 across a campus, right? You can do that, but also measure the delay and jitter between those two sites. Okay. And that protocol and that capability is widely deployed by every major vendor all over the world. So SPB gives us 95% of what we need.
Okay, so why would Trill be getting all the airtime that it's getting today? I don't want to get into a competitive discussion, but just to simply say Trill seems to be the direction that...
Honestly, I think it's more about marketing of SDOs. That IEEE doesn't worry about marketing or sharing anything. It's a much smaller group of engineers working to focus on solving a problem. There's very little bit about marketing. The IETF is much more public. People perceive it much more open because everything's on mailing lists, and people in the IEEE generally just email each other directly. There's not as much mailing list stuff going on, even though it is there. But if you want access to the documentation, if you want access to anything, no one in the IEEE is ever going to stop you. Just email anybody. Yeah. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why we created a wiki page for this stuff.
Well, that's been my challenge. I've gone to look at...
And by the way, that wiki page is really good.
Well, I guess we better put that wiki page in the show.
Oh, thank you.
So which wiki page is that one?
I'm glad to see people are getting used to it.
Which wiki page is that one?
It would be the IEEE 802.1AQ, I think, is the key. If you just go to Wikipedia and search IEEE space 802.1AQ, you'll find fairly extensive documentation.
And a much easier to read format.
Yes.
Okay. So
I don't think nobody's going to argue that the IEEE documentation isn't a little bit difficult to read. You need to sit down with a good, strong cup of coffee and spend an entire day going through this stuff to understand it. And that's definitely true.
Yep.
To be fair, there's a reason for that, right, Peter? I mean,
it's detailed.
It's very, very detailed. It's amazing the amount of detail we have to add to this thing. But also it's important because there's a mass quantity of hardware engineers who have to design chips off this. That's why the IEEE goes to great lengths to make sure it's documented and level detail.
We spend a lot of time on every little detail.
Yeah, and I have to admit, I quit around page 200.
Yeah, that's when I wanted to quit too. But
see, that's always been a problem of mine with the IEEE, is that the opaqueness of the process and the density of what comes out of it makes it, obviously as an enterprise, my main focus is as an enterprise engineer, and I need. I'm sitting on large networks, architecting on a 5 to 10 year horizon, and I'm trying to look at what the IEEE is doing, and it's opaque, and I can't get any feel for what's happening. But I also can't afford to spend 2 weeks, deep diving through a technology trail to try and work out what are the political motivations of the players, or, I shouldn't have to ring up somebody or know somebody like you to get answers to those questions. It should be freely available.
I agree. But do you ever worry about that with spanning tree or RSTP or MSTP or even fast Ethernet or gigabit Ethernet?
Well, yeah.
You just know that when you turn it on, it works.
Yeah, now, 10 years later, after 20 years later, yes, yeah. Because the material's out there and the knowledge is built up. But I'm now looking at building data mm-hmm. centers or...
But it took that long for MPLS.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took that long for MPLS as well. I mean, in most networking protocols, and those of us that start in the early days of the protocol to the time when we actually visit a customer with a 100 node network running it, it's a good 10 years.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to matter what the protocol is. It always seems to take about 10 years.
In fact, the nice thing about this is all of us have very intimate relationships because most of us on this call from the SPB side have patents and MPLS. So there's a reason why SPB looks the way it does. We learned a lot of lessons the hard way. But we also learned that
it's good to hear.
It takes a lot of work to get this stuff out there. But additionally, right, we also realized people are going to want to know about this beforehand like we saw with MPLS. So there is IEEE spec. There's the wiki page. But we also wrote the ISIS document from the ISIS working in the IETF as a complete description of the mm-hmm. protocol. So not only is it telling you what TLV ID numbers and what RFC number you have, you can read that and get exactly what you need to know about how the protocol works.
Right.
Yeah, and you see, that's exactly what Greg and myself find missing in the IEEE process. Because if you don't want to get directly involved, but you still need to understand what's going on, you just go to various IETF pages and you have all the drafts. You can read them. You can see where things are moving.
Yeah, I can intuit things like political positioning. Like, you know, you look at the IETF stuff and you can see that, you know, company B is heading off in the committee and company C is going orthogonal to that. And then, you know, company H is attacking them on this front to obviously block the standard and slow down. And you can make comments about that sort of thing. Whereas in the IEEE, unless I know somebody or get somebody to give me special permission, and you know, to have access to the secret cabal of knowledge, you know, I don't get it. Right?
Well, there's no secret cabal. You can easily ask any one of us for the password. It's so well known out there. A Google search will give it to you. Right? No one's trying to hide it. The only real reason why there's a password there is just the certain esoteric rules of the IEEE from the copyright perspective. It's not because anyone's trying to hide information.
No, I understand that. Right? But the widely held perception is that the IEEE is closed until the final document comes out. I didn't know that it was reasonably well open until I made a comment and then people started to say, you know, it's actually quite, here's the details. It's not a secret, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, hopefully we can help dispel that myth a little bit. You know, I think each standard body has its pros and its cons. You know, I've spent time at the ITU, where you know you can hear paint drying literally at the speed that some of the things go there. I spent time at the IETF, where unless you're drinking large amounts of coffee and paying attention, tremendously important things can pass by in the flash of an eye, and a decision can be made before you even, open your eye. And the IEEE tends to be a little bit between the two, where things can go a little slowly for your taste sometimes, but you always have a chance to get involved in a decision and get your input into the decision. It doesn't happen so blindingly.
Well, I've said the same thing to Peter Condon. I spoke to Peter Condon 9 months ago about this. Sorry, Paul Condon. 9 months ago about this, and he went and said, look, you know, it's just a peg. He said, well, you know, that's just the way it is. When my attitude is that's the wrong answer. The answer is you need to fix that.
Yeah, it's not really so much that it's opaque. It just it appears opaque. None of the engineers involved will ever hold you back from hearing anything. There's no secret handshakes or hats that we wear or anything like that. In fact, it's very open, but it's also really interesting when you think about being an active member of both. Actually, I've been active in IETF way longer, nearly a decade now, compared to the IEEE, which has only been a couple of years. The process to get a standard starting in IEEE is much, much more methodical, and you really have to prove the need for something. You just not simply someone throws in a draft and a working group hums to get it accepted, right? It's you got to prove to all the people there, and it's also extremely difficult and nearly impossible for any one vendor to play political games because everything's held up to such high standards and very much in the open. There's no backroom discussions. All of the intricate details of the standard are discussed right there in a room. And that can be a bit painful, to be quite honest, when you have somebody projecting up a PDF document and you're discussing the wording of a paragraph and why it's worded that way.
I don't question the competency of the IEEE, but I do sometimes – I think the general perception by most people would be that the opaqueness is frustrating at times. And the pace is also frustrating. So
I absolutely hear you on the pace, and I certainly wish things could be sped up. As far as the opaqueness is concerned, those of us interested in SPB have, you know, done a fair amount to lessen the opaqueness in terms of getting out there talking about it and putting up the wiki in particular. And I'm reasonably certain the IEEE and other folks at the IEEE working on things that they consider to be important do similar things. And so it's probably, you know, maybe it's not the standards bodies organization to advertise widely what it's doing. It's up to the folks that are interested in what's being standardized to get out there and push it.
That's very true.
Maybe the reflection is on us. Maybe we haven't done a good enough job getting the message out there. But, you know, there've been a lot of turmoil in the industry recently.
Yeah.
So it's not been that easy.
So let me ask one final question on the political side, and then let's return back to the technologies. Is Cisco doing stuff with SPB? Are we going to see something from them?
And they're very active in the standard. In fact, they are the ones that introduced the first additional part on top of AQ. I forgot the ability into SPB.
Okay. And so one other question I wanted to ask is, we had a podcast a couple of weeks back with the guys from the OpenFlow Foundation.
Oh, yeah.
And there's some interesting concepts coming out of that, and that's a long way from being, you know, anything, although they've got some pilot stuff. Is OpenFlow orthogonal to SPB, or is it compatible with or related to, you know, what's your view on that?
OpenFlow is very interesting because it comes up in conversation. In the meetings that I'm in, it comes up in conversation at least once every 2 or 3 days. And everybody's sort of asking the question, how would it be used and where would it be used and why would it be? It comes up, it gets marvelous advertising, and everybody seems to know about it, but we're not quite sure exactly how to use it in a really real context.
Any time that I've had conversations about it is when I'm at Bell Labs. That's the only time I've ever been asked a question about OpenFlow is literally when I'm at Bell Labs in the research area. I never, ever hear anybody from an enterprise or, you know, to a service provider asking anything about OpenFlow. And it is a very interesting technology. I don't mean to detract from it at all. I actually find it very interesting.
I would just add, you know, one point that I'd like to make about protocols like OpenFlow, because OpenFlow is essentially a centralized controller controlling potentially hundreds of distributed switches. And we in the routing world, because my background is routing, we did this very early on with ATM, right? We built these centralized controllers, and because distributed control is non-trivial to do. It's why the internet works so beautifully, because it's a fully distributed control plane, very resilient. But we tried doing centralized controllers, and we were never successful with centralized controllers. And so when I look at something like OpenFlow, where we have a centralized controller that is going to be controlling hundreds of thousands, millions even, of flows, I'm not quite sure how that's going to work. So my mind is open on the subject, but I'm just, you know, on the skeptical side based on my past experiences. But if they can come up with something great,
yep,
you know, we're all for it.
Yeah, to my mind, it's not the controller that's the flawed, it's the communication between the controller and the remote point.
Yeah,
well,
and
the controller can also be a problem,
and
right? So what happens when the controller has a problem or a bug?
Well, the controller is a switch. It has to receive all packets until flows are assigned.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another interesting.
Anyway,
so
the answer is too far away to tell. And for the time being, we're going to see SPB being used. You know, how close is the SPB to being finished or being done?
Well,
one of us
on here is already selling it, deploying it. So,
Peter mentioned
Roger?
A second ago.
Keep Roger, right?
So Peter even mentioned a second ago, though, before Roger, is that IANA has already assigned all of our code points. We're pretty much just finalizing the techno speak inside the IEEE document. You should see an RC pop out here very, very soon.
Okay, but when are we going to see the first product?
We do, as I said in the beginning, we do have a product in the market that is using the latest, let's say, standard revision, and is operational, and it's generally available and deployed in networks. So we are ready. We are out there. Pre-standard version actually was shipped by Nortel in 2008. So Nortel built networks, quite large networks, carrier networks at that point in time, with dozens
including data centers,
that's correct, dozens of nodes running the Mac and Mac version of SPB. And we are at the point now where we are doing interoperability tests with other vendors with the standards-based TLV implementations with our infrastructure, with our devices. So we are shipping, so it's out there, and actually I think ahead of the Trill game, we have done multi-vendor interoperability tests, which have been very successful. Actually, just last week, we have proven vMotion across the multi-vendor SVB deployment, which has been successfully passed.
Yeah, and your customers will only need to do a software upgrade to get the totally standard version, right?
Absolutely, that's correct, yes. We are the fast path, since this is Mac in Mac, as we said, which is PBB, which is standardized in 2008, it's 1AH, there is no change in the fast path. This is just TLV adjustments that are now done on the control plane to the final standard implementation, but we don't expect any changes anymore happening, so therefore we're there. And if there are changes, then it's a software update for our customers, yes.
And I'd just like to say, Ivan and Greg, if you guys would like, or viewers or listeners would like a live demonstration at some point, if there's some way to record it, I'd be happy to, and I'm sure Roger would be happy to show you a real network and let somebody kick the tires, type some commands, and see some things actually working.
That's correct. Yes, absolutely.
Not sure how we do it, but we'll give it a go.
No, you have to record the video and not just the voice, you know.
Greg, I have a great idea.
Yep.
You remember our friend Stretch from the TechField Day?
Yeah.
He's hosting a public lab that anyone can access.
Yeah.
So I guess a few guys would ship him a few boxes. He would gladly put them in the lab and allow anyone to play with them.
Does he have a working implementation of vCenter?
No,
he doesn't.
No.
Not yet.
Yeah, we've got, you know, that's the problem, is that setting up all of that stuff, while it's not that hard, it is, does require a day or two of fiddling and appropriate hardware.
Yeah.
Well, I'll just think more.
We've got a lot of that stuff set up here.
I still feel we haven't covered the basics somewhere along the line.
So you haven't covered the basics?
Yeah.
So let me explain something that I usually explain to my customers, and this is probably
that would be perfect. A pitch.
That'd be perfect.
Yep.
I think where it makes click, right? So one thing I'd like to add here, to in terms of how traffic is, or the connectivity is established across an SPB cloud, the Ethernet control plane. And what's the Ethernet control plane? Ethernet control plane. This is basically what SPB ISI is replaced. Is the flooding and learning is removed on the core devices, on the SPBM devices, and learning topology FIPS population is done by ISIs. I think it's important that this SPB cloud, this SPB region, doesn't do any flooding and learning at all in the core. So ISIs is taking over and does that. The learning piece is only at the access where the service instances are connected to the SPB cloud. I think it's important to get that picture that SPB is doing the ISI is taking over the population of the forwarding databases. The packets in the core, in the SPB cloud, are forwarded based on source test MAC addresses. And that means the FIP tables are populated, forwarding information, or the FIP filtering information bases are populated like every bridge does. But again, it's not populated by flooding and learning. It's ISIS that populates those tables. And that's what makes this so extremely robust, because it's a control plane that pushes it down. And there is only an update, a change of those FIP tables, if there is a link change or a membership change at the edge. Otherwise, this is perfectly robust and sits there sitting waiting for an adjustment. So I think that's an important piece to understand how the core, SPP core, establishes itself.
Okay. So let me just walk through the packet flow, frame flow with you.
Okay.
Packet flow. How many times have I said the word packet flow over the years and never said frame flow? It's just a whole different way of thinking about it, isn't it? I have a server which egresses a Ethernet frame from its network adapter. It arrives on the edge switch. The edge switch has a MAC table. It looks up that MAC address and says, that's got to go across my SPP backbone in my data center. So the ingress port says maps that, and it says the destination MAC address is on the other side of the SPP call. So that switch then encapsulates it MAC in MAC. It straps a new MAC header on the front, which uses the chassis link state ID. Am I correct?
Yeah,
there?
The chassis source ID. Yeah.
Chassis source ID. That's right. Syntax.
Yeah,
I didn't quite get it right.
The chassis MAC.
The MAC address of the source where it's just arrived.
Because that. And then what happens is the outbound routing table then says to get from this MAC chassis combination to that destination, that MAC address, send it to that chassis ID over there. And then so it goes across the backplane. Now, because it's a multipath, layer 2 multipath, and the ISIS backplane between all of the mesh, the 10 mesh switches in the mesh, it can actually then route it via up to 16 paths across that.
Yes, the decision is made on ingress into the fabric,
yep.
And then it selects one of the 16 paths for a particular flow.
Right.
And then
the MAC
flow
address.
Can take another. Yes,
right,
exactly.
Okay. So the actual packet, the only thing that happens is it gets another MAC address added to the front, which actually contains the chassis ID of the destination.
Yeah, if you're in SPBM mode, yes. In SPBB, you would simply just switch on the VID. You wouldn't add a new MAC header. You just do on the VID.
So the VID, the VLAN ID, is SPVV is like stateless, a stateful. So the receiver then actually says, well, if it's coming with that VLAN ID, I know where to send it because I've got a routing table that I can look up for that table.
Well, it can, or you can just assign the whole port to that VID. So any frame coming in from PCs, right, would simply be put on that particular VID, or they can be coming in already on a VID. There could be any combination of ways you'd attach it to that VID.
Okay, and that's basically all that happens. And at the edge, that access port where the original MAC address comes ingress can, of course, be connected to legacy switching infrastructures running STP, RSTP, MSTP, and all those types of things. So in terms of integrating it into an existing networking infrastructure, you can create a 2 or 3 switch fabric where you actually start to connect this stuff together and then progressively move the fabric further and further out as you add more and more switches. Is that also correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Right, something you would want to add before, because you used the case where you had already known where the destination is.
Mm-hmm.
But usually in the first flow of the frame or of the packet, it doesn't know where the destination is. So when it reaches the first SPB BEB, the backbone edge bridge, when it reaches the first SPB BEB, it will send it. If it doesn't know where the destination is, it will send it to all the members of this ICID. So it will basically flood it across the SPB infrastructure, but only to the endpoints which are member of the service ID.
And along a multicast tree defined by a source path calculation. It's not flooding like the old Ethernet. It's simply just dropping one frame on a multicast tree, so only one copy of that packet is flowing on one tree, kind of like a PIM-SSM kind of capability.
Right. The impact of an undirected unicast or an unknown unicast or a broadcast frame is mitigated in the core.
Yeah, it's incredibly tiny. But it's also beautiful if you're doing multicasts underneath because now you have shortest path multicast for even IP multicast.
Okay, so now I want to come back and talk a little bit about the OAM. So the other feature of SPB is OAM. OAM is operational administration and management and involves the process of putting information either into or around the frame, so even in the overlaying protocols or in the frames itself, to actually give you end-to-end information about the flows or the status of the packets or the devices. This is a teleco service provider type space where end-to-end state can always be determined about the flow itself. Now, SPB has a lot of these OAM features, and it can monitor.
Well, no, I wouldn't say SPB has those features. Ethernet has those features.
We inherit existing behavior. There's literally been, I don't know, how many thousands of man years of effort have gone into the creation of Ethernet ONM 802.1AG and also YDOS 1731 or SLA and so forth monitoring. So there's a huge legacy of stuff that it just works. So we didn't invent anything. We don't take credit or, you know, for that stuff. We just get to steal it and use it for free.
Okay, so this work's been done previously, but we just not used it up until now? Like, why haven't I been seeing this till today?
Well, predominantly it's used in service provider networks, too. So if you're buying an Ethernet circuit for your enterprise, you're using it. You still know you're using it. And anytime you call for a tech support, there's somebody on the line running one of these AG packets to test the connectivity between any of the sites or to test a delay or test any jitter or anything like that.
Okay.
But it's used heavily in wireless environments, service provider environments all over the world.
Okay.
And Greg, it's now even supported in Cisco boxes. So if you have two routers connected to carrier Ethernet.
Actually, it is.
You can run end-to-end OAM between the routers. So it's like BFD, but over Ethernet.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
I'm not a service provider guy, so... You know,
no, this is
an
enterprise
stuff.
Feature. You should know
about
this.
Yeah. All right.
So really, you don't even have to use all this stuff. It just has regular ping and traceout capability as well. And that's the nice thing. If all you ever want to do is just ping and traceroute, and whether unicast or Mellanox, you have that. You don't have to go with all this extra stuff, but it's all there as a toolkit ready for you.
Okay.
Yeah, in our labs and between the different vendor switches, we can already do... You know, we can set up SDB networks, set up an ISID, and then do layer 2 ping and layer 2 trace route from anywhere to anywhere across the ISID. It's just there and it just works. And it may have been transparent to you, but to people operating very large networks, they're already quite familiar with this stuff.
I can't know everything.
Oh, by the way, Greg,
we're all learning.
Greg, on a 6500.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like you have ping Ethernet command.
Yeah.
Which actually does the CFM messages.
Okay. See, my problem is I've got bitches to do that. They probably have
to do that. If you send a few my way, I need some help. usually you take the layer 3 command like ping, and you normally have an IP address. It would be ping space MAC and then... Mac
I do know it's there. I've just never used it. So
we can even do L2 ping and then an IP address, and we get an L2 response.
That's a nice feature.
Yeah, and there's some very interesting, while we're discussing the OANM, there's some very interesting properties that Ethernet OANM, and in particular AQ, give you are this thing of fate sharing. And one of the things that we hear from customers that deploy very large especially carriers, but this almost certainly will be true in the data center, large data centers as well, is that when you get an asymmetric failure, that is one direction of the path is working, the other direction isn't, it's one of the most expensive things to try to track down and figure out. And so having packets associated with a flow following the same forward and reverse path allows them to share fate, which means that the forward and reverse directions die at the same time. And that's a very, very useful thing because it makes debugging much, much simpler. And so we've adopted that philosophy with shortest path bridging, and the debugging tools that you use for shortest path bridging, they know that the routing is symmetric. And so if AG traces fail, you know that something's gone wrong, exactly where it's gone wrong in the network.
Even if it's only single direction failure, you can easily find it with an L2 ping because it follows the same path as the traffic flow. You find the failure right there. But if you have a non-congruent back and forth path, it's very, very hard to find out whether your debugging is finding the problem or not because it can just use another path.
Yeah. So one other thing that we find very, very nice, and I spend a lot of time in my lab playing with this equipment, is if you stick a sniffer between two boxes doing SDB, and it could be a 50 or 100 node network, if you put a sniffer in the middle of that link and you watch a packet, you capture a packet going through, you can say exactly which ingress SDB device did it come from, which egress SDB device it came from, and you can tell exactly what route it must have gone through And of course, you know the source host and the destination host, right?
And the service.
That ability and the service. So that allows you to very accurately monitor what's going on. You know, if we just spray the traffic around through the network at the ingress, it's a lot more difficult to figure out what's going on in the core of a network. And that's something people who operate very large networks, they complain about the cost of hop-by-hop hashing of packets and very much like this deterministic routing behavior because it reduces one of their largest costs.
Okay.
So I'll even give a use case for that, right? Think about fiber channel or Ethernet. Having the ability to have all that SONET testing capability that you didn't normally have in the past available for fiber channel Ethernet connections between, and you can guarantee that they're going one path to the other. You can also do some other things where you say, for any one of those given 16 paths, you can send email across one or eight, you know, high-performance computer across another set and regular data across another, or any combination of the load balancing capability, and then you can choose how you want to do it. And traffic engineering, as Peter said earlier, is fully available for anyone's paths too.
Yeah, I think we actually gave a little demonstration of that. One of the Avaya folks and myself at Nanog, we actually did a little bit of an overview of some of that stuff on some live switches. If your audience is interested, if they go to the Wikipedia page and on IEEE 802.1AQ and look down further at the bottom, there's a set of sources, source links. You'll find there's several different presentations. One in particular, the longer Nanog presentation, the last, I think, 30 minutes of it were a live demonstration showing some of the OANM capabilities. And, you know, people are interested to take a look at that.
Yeah, I watched, you gave a great presentation about SPB at Nanog 50, which I remember.
Thank you.
Watching, and that was my first introduction to SPB. I'll try.
Were you there?
No, of course not.
Oh, okay. It's much better than the recording.
I live in the UK. Why would I be at Nanog?
Oh.
I'm an enterprise network architect who lives in the UK. At what relevance does Nanog have to me? Zero.
You know, a network is a network is a network, right? I mean,
no, it's not. No. Nanog networks in North America are completely different to everybody else's. They've got the European networks are completely different to North American telco environments, and the technology tracks that as well.
Well, my bad.
That's not true, because I go to both places, and they're the same.
I was going to make a broader point. You're right in the details, but yeah. my points were fairly broad, that everybody wants to reliably get packets from one place to another. Everybody wants to know when something goes wrong, what went wrong. Everybody wants to be able to fix it. Everybody wants to do it at the cheapest possible cost, you know. So, and I don't think the end of prizes are any different with respect to the carriers or the data centers in regards to those points. It's just that they have a bit, some of them have more money to spend, some of them their pain points are a little different. But these protocols, for the most part, whether it's MPLS, whether it's shortest path bridging, whether it's Trill or other approaches, all eventually have to address these requirements.
Yeah,
and I think historically, you know, We've been through this the fire here quite a few times with the protocol we worked on, or Paul and myself and Roger. And, you know, we've been through the fire, and some of what you're seeing here represents, or a lot of what you're seeing represents those experiences and what we know works and what we know doesn't work. And is it perfect? No, it's not perfect, but it encompasses a tremendous amount of experience. And so I think those are important things to keep in mind, that yes, there's a carrier space, yes, there's an enterprise, yes, there's a campus, but we kind of all want them to work, and we all want them to be cheap, and we want to debug them, and those are common things.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think I'm done. Anybody else got anything they want to raise? Oh, Ivan, you got any more points?
No.
Talk myself comit.
You were perfect.
No, I'm not.
I mean, all four of you.
Yeah.
Not just you, Greg. You were too bad yourself, Ivan.
Hopefully, we gave some good information and a little bit of entertainment to your listeners. And if your listeners want to get more data, you know, they're welcome to contact sort of myself anyway. I'm sure the other guys would have no problem.
And absolutely.
If you want to do details, we're happy to do that too.
That's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. And this show has been astonishingly nerdy and very deep, If you've got feedback, then by all means send it to me, and we'll be more than happy. I'm pretty keen to find out if anybody wants to hear more about SPB. If we've gone too deep, then get in contact. If we haven't gone deep enough, get in contact. We'll be getting some contact details from the guests on the show about how to get more information from them and their companies, so hit the blog post for more details. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining this week. Paul Unbehagen, who works for Alcatel-Lucent, Roger Lapu, who works for Avaya, and Peter Ashwood-Smith, who works for Huawei, for joining us. Thanks very much, guys. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy days for joining in.
Our pleasure. Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you.
No problems. And Ivan, what are you going to be doing this week?
One more day, and then it's a week of holidays, finally.
Yeah, it's a royal wedding here in the UK. The only reason I know is because...
Yeah, you're lucky. You start a day
early.
That's
right. It's a public holiday for me tomorrow, so I don't get paid. I don't get paid because if I don't go to work, I don't get paid. And, of course, I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com, or you can find me on the Twitter at etherealmind. As always, send feedback to packetpushers@gmail.com. You can check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave comments. You can also follow us on the Twitter at @packetpushers, where we just basically tell you when the show's been published or if there's any other secret details about what's going on. And remember, too much networking would never be enough.